Take RFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This programme was first broadcast on RFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. Shane's not here tonight because I'm in Whakatane. I'm with Dr. Rob Whitbourne. He is from Te Whanganui and he works in conservation.
Kia ora, Sam. Lovely to be here. Lovely to meet you.
Thank you for having me. Where'd you grow up?
In my early years, in a little place called Ōwhanga, in the middle of the North Island, just south of Taumarunui. And then when I was 10, my family moved to Australia. We had a farm over there, just outside of Newcastle. So, farm life over there. Grew up in the bush over there and came back to Aotearoa when I was 25.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
I had no single aspiration. When I was growing up, like a lot of farm kids, you love the life in parts, but you loathe the work. And your great aspiration is to get off the farm as soon as you're old enough and can get a vehicle. So yeah, when I was 18, left the farm and went and lived in the city.
What'd you do in the city?
I was at uni for a little while. Just bummed around, pretty much a beach bum. In Newcastle for a few years, just really drifting, not really doing anything specific. And then, in my mid-20s, came back to Aotearoa.
What brought you back here?
My mum, who's Te Whanganui, and my father's Pākehā Australian, she passed away over there, and that was in 97, so I was the eldest, so came back here for things to do with her tangi. And because I've been away since I was 10 years old, kind of opened my eyes to how big our family was or is over here, and the places, I guess, that we call home on this side. And so after her passing in 1997 and being the oldest too, I kind of felt an obligation to come back and sort of be the connection for my younger siblings. And the rest of the family.
Had you managed to maintain the connection to here?
Well, probably as best as you could living on a farm in the 80s in Australia. And it was before cheap air travel and the internet and all of those sorts of things. So we always felt like we were from here and we happen to have ended up in Australia and our family would come and visit quite regularly. We had a good sense of, you know, being Australian and being from New Zealand as well.
Did it change much?
When I came back?
Yeah.
It is a little bit, you know, when you leave a place like that, it is a little bit like there's a sort of big gap in the middle and you come back and things that you remember as being huge are all of a sudden very small. You know, just in a simple physical sense, the hill at the back of the homestead was a giant mountain. You come back as a 25-year-old and say, what? You're looking at that thing. You thought that was huge. That was a mountain. That was our universe, you know. That was our world. It was kind of limited to the farm and the places you would play as a kid. And then when you come back as a young adult, you know, the world's your oyster, really. You know, you can travel more. So I spent a lot of time just hitchhiking around and just getting odd jobs, labouring kind of stuff and farm work and things like that.
So you're now working in conservation.
Yep.
How did that start for you?
The work is really what like I've always been into nature. Like everyone in my family will tell you that that was an interest since I was very young, and through my teenage years and all that. If there was at a whānau sort of gathering, birthdays and stuff like that, if there was any kind of discussion came up around environmental things, I'd be the one sort of arguing with my uncles that no, cutting trees down is not a good thing. No, putting dams up everywhere and blocking rivers is not a good thing. So yeah, but my family joke that they have strong memories of those healthy debates with an idealistic teenager, I guess, and my uncles at the time.
Okay, another step back. Where did that come from?
Where did that come from? I think we, as a family, myself and my siblings were really fortunate in that we... Orphong was a tiny little town, and I think the school may have had like 60 kids at it when we were there. And it's very much out in farm and bush area, sort of half an hour south of Taumarunui. And then we moved to a farm in Australia. So we were lucky in that, our playgrounds and our experience of life were all based around the bush, in both here in New Zealand and in Australia. And that, my father's a bushman from way back in Oz, so when you grow up with people like that, they just impart on you a sense of understanding and knowledge about the things around you. So you kind of grow up knowing what different trees look like. Plant ID is not a foreign thing to you. You kind of grow up knowing where different birds nest and how trees change during the seasons, and all of that's wrapped up in farm life, everything that goes with raising animals and growing crops and stuff.
So you weren't tempted back to the farm?
And I always had a curiosity about life and experiences, so I sort of tended to wander more and chase leads wherever they kind of went.
So a sense of understanding your curiosity, is it a passion?
Yeah, you'd probably call it that. I don't really think of anything in my life as a passion, but I guess as you get older, you kind of see that you are definitely drawn in certain directions, and.
So how do you go from that sense of understanding and it's always been there to it actually being the thing?
Well, for me, growing up in the bush in Australia and then coming back here, I had very little understanding of the kiwi bush. I didn't grow up hunting or living in it the way I played in it as a little kid, went to Australia, and then, teenage years on a farm, you spend a lot of time on motorbikes and with your dogs and, on horses and stuff like that. So it was really foreign to me. So for a long time when I came back, I had this kind of sense of the New Zealand bush as being this kind of foreboding dark forest kind of thing. And it didn't really have that much appeal. Like, I liked being out in the bush and doing stuff, but I certainly wasn't drawn to any kind of work or life. I was mainly drawn towards physical work, so working on farms and working in construction as a labourer, because, that being on a farm, you're kind of used to being on the end of a shovel and, you know how to use a hammer and all of those sorts of things. So about 15 years ago now, I came across an ad for Arungoa Wananga, so Wananga about traditional medicines. I went along to that, and that was with Rob McGowan. And from that very first, that was a weekend Wananga, that very first weekend, it really opened my eyes to the New Zealand bush. And for a long time before that, when I came back, I learned te reo, so I learned to speak and had been involved in different Māori things and had my whānau life here in the Eastern Bay and within whānau Apanui. But I hadn't really found something that was as much of a a strong sort of pull, I guess, a singular thing. You know, like a lot of people do kapa haka, maurapa, waka'ama, there's all sorts of Māori kaupapa, but no specific one had really sort of pulled me into it, other than te reo. I was really committed to te reo probably from the early 2000s and kind of dedicated a lot of time to that. But it was rongoa that really gave me that feeling of knowing the bush, and that's really similar to what I'd grown up with in Australia. So that, yeah, understanding of how everything fits together, just understanding what's there, really. Most people go in the bush and can probably barely name 10 trees very well. So, yeah, that was a real start for that kind of turning towards nature in a more specific sort of way.
Yeah.
And then I started the PhD in 2007, and that was focused on traditional crops and how their significance is maintained today, but particularly how Indigenous communities engage with organisations or people from outside of their communities to support things like agriculture. So here, like the Crown Research Institutes, there's a lot of research projects involving Māori or Mātauranga Māori, that kind of stuff. So part of the interest was here, but I've been backpacking in South America, and I'd left with a specific kind of thing that I wanted to do, which was find out where Kumara was from. And this was in my early 30s, and I hadn't been on that OE when I was younger. So, yeah, went on this mission to find out where Kumara was from and ended up in a place called Cusco in Peru, and met a guy there who had a project working with six hapu that was all focused on potato. Peru's one of the centres of potato. And his name's Alejandro Agumero, and he'd actually been out to Whakatāne a few years earlier and was a signatory on behalf of Peruvian Indigenous peoples for the Matatu Declaration. And so he, when I met him, you know, in Cusco, he said, "Oh, yeah, I've been over to New Zealand." I said, "Oh, where'd you go?" "Oh, a place called Whakatāne." You know, so it was, well, that's where we are today.
You probably know
it today. So that was, as soon as that happened, he was, you know, it was just a random backpacker that a mutual friend had put us in contact with. And from then he said, "Well, you know, if you ever want to come back and do some work with us, the invitation's there." So I came back, found a project with traditional crops, which was with Kumara over in Ngāti Porou, and found a university and a supervisor. So that was Auckland Union, the business school up there, and Manuka Hennedy was my supervisor. And so ended up going down that path for a long time, for a while.
So the research question was about how's the Kumara linked to Kumara communities and other organisations? Have I got that right?
Initially, the interest was how traditional crops, the significance of traditional crops is maintained amongst contemporary Indigenous communities. So those things that you say are of value, that you say are your taonga, that have been handed down, how do you maintain those? Do they retain their significance? How does it morph, you know, under contemporary circumstances? And then it moved more towards the organisational side of how the interaction plays out. So if you have a research institute, if you have a funding agency, how can they interact well with an Indigenous community? How can they avoid the pitfall of coming in as experts and telling people how to do things? Is there another way to do development and to do research? So yeah, it was focused on the organisational kind of aspects. So it would sit in organisational studies as a field.
Is that about the relationship between the, quote, science and the traditional understanding?
Yeah. So one of the key things was often knowledge is the social side of knowledge is not given as much attention as, you know, people focus on facts and finding things out and blah, blah, blah. And especially in terms of Western science and Indigenous knowledge systems, the focus is often on kind of factual knowledge and the kind of deeper assumptions, ontological stuff. So, and the social stuff is not given that much attention. And so what you end up is this kind of emphasis on difference based on, oh, here's the, I guess, the body of factual knowledge that one knowledge system has, and here's the body of knowledge that another one has, and we've got all this knowledge and you guys have got all that. Or at that kind of deeper assumptions level, oh, we see the world in this way and you see the... And so it tends to draw out difference, and it doesn't give much room for common ground or interaction. Whereas when you put more attention, I guess, on the social side of things, issues of, oh, is Mātauranga Māori or is Indigenous knowledge in Peru compatible, or can it interact with Western empirical knowledge? If you focus on the social, we'll give it more attention. Then the question is, well, how can the practitioners, the people that do Western science in these institutes, and the people that do Mātauranga Māori in these communities, or traditional knowledge from Quechuan people, how can they best interact? So an organizational take on that is we're really focused on how these groups of people can interact with each other. So questions of who has decision-making control, questions of how do you respectfully engage with and respond to each other's knowledge traditions, going to come to the fore. Because it's easy to go, well, an Indigenous way of seeing things, the physical world is imbued with a spiritual element, and empiricism doesn't deal with that, so therefore they're incompatible. Whereas if you look at it, oh, well, there's people who work and live basically in urban institutes, and there's others that live in rural communities. They speak different languages. They have different values. They make decisions in different ways. How can those come together in terms of those specific things? It gives you more scope to find the common ground, or the ways that you can interact with each other.
Is that common ground an acceptance of difference, an acceptance of tension?
Yeah. So there has to be an underlying attitude and set of values. That's not that each other is, completely right or anything like that, but just that each group has its own way of seeing things and has its own way of understanding better, understanding in more detail and that sort of thing. So there's huge ground to come together once you have it. And so things like having either mutual understanding of each other's culture, so having the competency and the flexibility to move across, or have people who are in the position to translate and to kind of navigate that for you, are really big things. And in the organisational sense, if you're saying the thing that a group of scientists bring to this particular endeavour is X amount of dollars and experiences in undertaking Western science, and the Indigenous people as well have their own sort of things that they bring to the field, but neither's really able to together collaborate and make decisions on stuff. If there's a degree of exclusion, you kind of tend to get nowhere. In terms of the aspirations of development, you don't really understand each other, and you tend not to. There's not much sort of permanent change or useful change, really. It just becomes an exercise to spend funding dollars, and someone gets well paid, and then they return home and get some publications out of it.
And that brings it back to the thing you said first, which is where the decision power lies. If it's consultation, whether it's token or not, if the decisions are still being made over on one side.
Yeah. And there was a case here with the project I worked with here. They had a huge amount of funding, $700,000 a year over 5 years. and the locals had very little say in how that might be used. So you, I mean, anyone that's listening that's familiar with research projects amongst communities would have seen this, that, you know, the experts all get charged out at an hourly rate and a bunch of them go somewhere and it's easy to clock up a 20k, 30k bill for a weekend or a week out with a community, Indigenous or otherwise. They go home, the money for the project gets billed for that. The organisation whacks a 30, 40, 50% admin fee on top of it, and you chew through hundreds of thousands of dollars really easily. You know? And if someone who's growing kumara or organic potatoes in an isolated area just needs a decent tractor, doesn't need a flash tractor, just needs a reliable tractor and a reliable harvester. That would cost $5,000 to get a reliable harvester. So you see these really strange imbalances saying, we're here to help you fellas do this thing, grow kumara, grow potato. But one side tends to benefit in a you know, material way, very clearly, and whereas the other's just kind of scratching their head going, oh, well, thank you for the Western science that you came and shared with us. We just need to be able to harvest our potatoes. That would be a start. And the Peruvian project was very different to that. They turned that completely around. So they needed goodwill on and experience on the side of the institutes that they worked with. But what they found over there was that when they had tried to work with their own government, they tended to run into these same obstacles. So, you know, it's a common story all around the world. When they went to international funding agencies, a lot of those strings weren't there, and there was a lot more ability to apply the available resources to what people actually needed. So there was, you know, a really big thing on their part, being strategic in who they align with, finding resources that weren't tied up in those nation, state, Indigenous community dynamics, and then come back to those local agencies and work with them. But they were setting the ground rules to a degree.
Did you come across any examples where the questions truly came from the Indigenous communities?
Questions.
I'd like to characterise that against the scientists kind of had a question, and they might have tweaked that a bit to make it look like it was answering the things for the communities.
I don't know. Like in those two examples, in both cases, my sense was that the farmers just they wanted some material support in what they were doing. So there was, you know, the ability to purchase equipment and other things, and build a greenhouse, do other stuff like that. And also to have that kind of respectful relationship where there's a recognition and a balance between both sides. And that relationship itself, lots of things would come out of it. So at times they would have specific questions, you know, there were like diseases that they were finding difficult, or soil fertility, you know, things like that. But in most cases, their concerns were more broader than a single technical sort of question. Theirs was, well, how can our community be healthy? How can our young people stay here instead of drifting off to urban centres? How can we do things so there's benefit for the individuals or smaller groups that are doing it, but with that's feeding into our well-being, I guess, as a community. So really their focus was on, you know, how can we as a people who've lived in this particular place, how can we maintain our community? Well, how can we revitalize in some cases? Because particularly here, people, you know, went up to the cities after World War II. It was happening before World War II, but it accelerated after World War II. So there's a good three generations that people have largely left their homelands, with a small number coming back. In Peru, it's a different situation, but often there would be those kind of community, hapu, iwi level sort of aspirations that were a big part of what they were doing, along with their personal, you know, motivation to, you know, grow the crop well, make some money out of it, those sorts of things.
That urbanisation must swing the balance in the direction of the Western science, with a loss of the depth and breadth of traditional knowledge.
Yeah, hugely. I mean, the hub of any knowledge system, is a community of people that do it. And if your community is depleted over generations, then that knowledge itself is weakened, or however you want to describe it. I mean, if there was a mass exodus of structural engineers out of their profession into doing something else, it just weakens the body, the community of people who practice that. And so mātauranga, for many Indigenous peoples, the same. Like, we do quite a lot of wānanga around the natural world and conservation and things like rongoā. And the story we often tell is how there was a missionary travelling in the 1840s, I think it was, and he brought along a friend who was a botanist out from Europe, and the botanist was collecting plant samples, and he collected about 300 plant samples and asked his friend, the missionary, "Oh, do you think these locals, these people in these little villages this was over in Waikato, would know these plants?" And he said, "Oh, well, I'll ask." So he asked him, and one fellow said, "Oh, yeah, I can give you some names." So he gave names for 300 plants. So trees, ferns, all sorts. And then they had the idea, they were talking about it that night, and they thought, "Well, hey, this Māori fellow could have said anything. He could have given us any name. Who knows what we've got no idea. He's just naming..."
Tall, spiky thing.
Tall, yeah. The name, the word for your thing, mati mati, for toes. "Oh, yeah, that's a mati mati." "Okay, mati mati, write it down." They got no idea. So they said, "Well, how about we ask someone different tomorrow?" "Okay. Well, we'll catch these Māoris out if he's been telling us porkies." A different guy came forward, and he named all 300. And out of the 300, there was one that had a different name.
Wow.
So this is in a single hapu, a single village in the 1840s. Two people could stand up and name 300 plants, and only, there'd be one that's wrong between them. So that I always like telling that story, because it really gives an insight into how much knowledge was around and how little there is today. Because in a room full of people, if you ask them, "Okay, so is there anyone here that can name 300 plants?" No. "Anyone 150? That's you're 50% of a tipuna level." No. "Okay, 50. Anyone can..." "You might get one or two if you're lucky." And then the majority are, maybe 10 or 15 that they can name. So I've got a feeling that level was maintained probably up until the early 1900s. But then as people, instead of getting the things that they need in life from the bush, as their food and other material things for building things or whatever came in different ways, that would have sort of just been sort of slowly. But then, with the urban migration post-World War II, it probably accelerated hugely, and to the situation where we are today, where most people don't know.
Is it getting stronger with a resurgence of Tereo?
Tereo's probably contributed a little bit, not hugely though. Most people live urban lives today. When smartphones first came out and there were apps, there was an app where you had to identify like logos. So it had McDonald's and a Ferrari logo and, all sorts of stuff. And most 10-year-olds could name a couple of hundred. So it was, the world that you're familiar with is the world that you know. And so that if 300 is a level of knowing things in your world, most adults could probably name close to 300 logos and, you know, other things like that just through the experiences in their life. So living away from the bush and not being dependent on it means that, you know, that's just going to... That level is just not going to be there. So for us working in conservation, a huge part of our work is how do we get people reconnected? How do we give them a chance to feel that they're part of those places? You know, not that they're people who happen to live in cities, but that there's a sense of kinship, you know, a relationship with the natural world, that when you stand next to anything, whether it's, you know, something as big as a totara or something as small as a mini-mini, that there's a feeling and an understanding that actually we are related. You know, we are of the same. So, yeah, I work in conservation, so a lot of it's just bureaucratic government agency stuff. But... hopefully that is, you know, servicing our ability to do, you know, to help people reconnect and to understand in those sorts of ways.
How do we do that reconnection?
Rungu is a big, I guess, passion of mine, and that's, we do a lot of rungu a wānanga and support people because that's, you know, like most things in life, if you have to find what that spark, the spark that's already there for people. If you're trying to, you know, convert people to something that's completely foreign to them, you know, you'll be pushing the proverbial uphill. But, you know, if you can find something that's of interest, that resonates, that they relate to, and then use that as an avenue. So rungu is one, but, you know, there's a lot of hunters around the place. If you can engage with hunters, and hunters have an amazing knowledge of the places that they hunt in. You know, no one walks the land the way hunters do these days. But it doesn't give you a complete knowledge of it, or even a really full knowledge of those places just hunting on its own. But it gives you that love of those places. Most people who hunt learn to hunt through their parents or their grandparents or older siblings teaching them. So hunting's, you know, it's part of that love that they have for each other is actually in those places. So, you know, that's different to someone who's interested in rungu or someone who's just interested in plants on a more, you know, they just have an interest in plants or birds or whatever. So, yeah, a lot of what we do is, you know, trying to find those things that people already have and how can we help, you know, build out from that and connect out, and all of that stuff, you know, strengthens what's already there. But it also often gives them a new insight. You know, there's a lot of hunters who've come to our rungu wānanga and they have very little understanding of, or their plant ID would be relatively small. But once they've spent even just a short time, like a weekend, getting to know, say, 40 or 50 plants, they go and hunt in all of those same places and they all come back and say, man, I see it in a completely different way now. I'm still doing what I've always done, you know, getting food and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But when you actually see the differences and start to notice things, and then as you're hunting or, you know, if you're trekking, spending time in the bush, whatever reason, through the seasons, you start to, once you've noticed the differences, then you start to notice how things have their own cycles. When things flower and berries come, how new growth appears, and all of that sort of layers onto what they're already doing, and, you know, starts to fill out. So I think in New Zealand, we're, you know, we're a highly urbanized country, but the bush isn't too far away and there's still a lot of people in the bush, so there's still a lot there, or there's something there to be built upon. You know, it's not like those connections have been lost completely.
Why? Why do we want people to do that?
Why do we want people to
yeah,
be connected.
Can't we just rely on Doc to manage the bush?
If your view is that, you know, the natural world is something to be managed, and then like lots of things in life, different people have companies that do different things, and we're Doc's just another organization. The thing we always try to bring people back to is that, you know, the natural world is not something to be managed. People are things to be managed. In general, you know, environmental management's not the best of terms. I never like that term. It's mostly people management. From a Māori perspective, the nature of reality is that we are all family. That's a simple premise. And from that, the question is, well, do you know your family? And do you care for your family? And so that's our motivation. You know, like I've seen it on a few different TV shows. There might be a whole lot of relatives of a person that are put in an audience. And the person's come and sat in the audience, and then the host of the show talks to that person, and they're unaware that they've got all of these relatives around them. And then they ask a question, can the cousins and the uncles and aunties of Joe Bloggs please stand up? And then they all stand up around, and you see this revelation in the person. These people, they were all there the whole time, but I didn't think of them and I didn't know them as family. And then all of a sudden, I'm surrounded by family. Yeah, and so for me, I've always had a sense of that. And so it wasn't a question of, why should we do this? This was just doing what was always in my nature, I guess, to support that and to help other people to feel that. And if that's not how you see the world, well, that's all fine. But
is it,
maybe if you have a little glimpse and if you like it,
do you feel it when you go to a degraded patch of bush?
Yeah. That's in conservation, that's the aim. I mean, to me, this whole thing of this sense of connection and kinship with everything around us is not something that's expressed for those specific purposes. But if you've been in a forest where you feel that, you know, you are a relative of everything there, and maybe a relatively young relative, one of the babies in the family, and then you see that place, those places being damaged, or things being lost, you know, and lost forever, extinctions. It does, I think, create a feeling of aroha for those places and everything in them, but also a motivation to do something about it.
Are the timescales of the natural processes, are they a challenge to that? I'm thinking of the sign that used to be at the entrance to the Karori Wildlife Sanctuary. It said, "Welcome to our 500-year journey."
Mm.
And you can walk around here and see 2,000-year-old trees.
Yeah.
We don't live that long. Is it hard for us to grasp those sorts of timescales?
I think for a certain percentage of the population, yes, definitely. For me personally, no. There was a lovely quote I saw just a couple of days ago. I can't remember the exact words, but it was something like, I plant trees knowing that I will never sit in their shade, but I plant them. So the time scale of this stuff is, sure, you know, like it's kind of, you can sort of throw out figures like, oh, this is, it'll take a normal, healthy, mature forest is usually sort of a minimum of 500 years. So if we're trying to re-establish something, then it's a 500-year journey or a 2,000-year journey or whatever. And I think, you know, the value of those is that it jerks people out of their kind of day-to-day momentum of working and doing things and, you know, of my time frames are next payday, couple of years, all my kids are growing up, you know, and it kind of jerks you out. If you just take a moment to really think about, oh, geez, there's things going on here that take 500 years. I think that's a really good thing because it pulls us out of our own worlds and reminds us that we're in something a lot bigger than ourselves. You know, and as you start to learn more and more about the natural world, those time frames just get bigger and bigger. You know, the oldest Kaikatea fossil remains are, I think, 180 million years old. So if Kaikatea has been here for 180 million years, who are we to go and knock them all down? And the vast majority of Kaikatea have been knocked down. They tended to grow on the plains. So along with, you know, 95% of our wetlands being drained, there's probably a similar percentage of the big Kaikatea forests. And often there's little patches that were left. Here in Whakatane, we've got a place called White Pine Bush just outside of Whakatane. Over in Brisbane, there's Grey's Bush. There's these little it's like we cleared everything and we just left these a couple of football field size bits. To remind us, you know, Tuatara is a classic one. Yeah, that was around when dinosaurs were here, 200 million years old. To me, when you learn about that stuff and understand it, and you're seeing that in terms of this kind of kinship, we're all family kind of worldview, it really gives you a sense of being a little baby amongst all of these things. Around us, and it makes you question, well, what's this little baby done to the world, and does it need to continue in that way? You know, could we, if we're able to cause this much destruction, are we able to heal in the same way? So there's a lot of people out there I think would say yes, we can, and but we are
also a kind of a weird sense, perhaps, of urgency, but also we don't have to solve this, have this solved by tomorrow. You know, we can have a vision of returning the plains to wetlands, and we've got to start somewhere. Let's do it.
Yeah.
We don't have to have this, you know, how do we all convert it all tomorrow? It's worth, you know, A, we have to protect those islands, the little patches.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're in a time of accelerated destruction and accelerated extinctions, and you know that no one can deny that. And so, there is a sense of urgency. I feel a sense of urgency, and even on the side of in terms of, you know, things that are unique to Māori people, there's an urgency there, and that's, you know, been really recognised, I guess, probably from the 70s. You know, those people that had their early formative years in that world that hadn't seen a big loss. So they were children before World War II. You know, by the 70s and 80s, they were sort of, you know, getting on, and many were passing. So the things that they had received as young children, growing up in communities where te reo was the first language, you know, it's, you know, as a language learner, you just can't replicate that. You know, all you can do is act in a way that allows those people who had those experiences, for those experiences to come to you, for you to feed into them, and, you know, to pass them on. And yeah, when you look at those two things, cultural loss and environmental loss, both have accelerated in the last 50 years, and both have led to extinctions. You know, in Australia, there was over 200 individual languages amongst people over there. Now there's probably maybe 15 that are still spoken as first languages. And all of those are under threat. None of those, you could say, without a concerted effort, are going to be maintained. So, you know, within a relatively short time span, from a kahikatea's perspective, a 200 million year perspective, 200 languages, well, I'd say 180 are pretty much gone, and the other 20 are precarious. Well, there's a huge effort going on in Australia, the same way there has been here, but here it's a single language, and over there there's, you know, at least 20 that people are really concentrating on, so it's a real challenge. So in one sense, yeah, I feel that urgency, and in the other sense, this stuff is really big. You know, like the little change we make now will contribute to the little things that my kids and their kids will do in the future. So I don't have an aspiration to see the kahikatea that I plant. I don't feel any great need to be around in 500 years to see it at maturity. But, you know, I hope the people around me and, you know, my own kids have got the attitude, you know, to see those things continue to be looked after and let them mature and return to the places that they call home.
Neville Peat in Dunedin has a nice quote, which is something along the lines of, every generation unwittingly sets the bar lower. And I think there's something in what you're talking about. It's almost like
an optimist.
it's a fight back on that, because there's longer stories. You know, the stories tell us of what it used to be like and what it could be like.
Yeah.
So if we can reconnect that connection, maybe it'll fight back across that. I have some questions to end us with.
Yep.
Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
No, I don't. I would love to hear one. I would love to hear a good one. Have you got a good one?
Yeah, but it's too long to do now.
That's one of those things, you know, like if you couldn't explain it sitting at a bus stop to a stranger, it's probably too wordy. So, it's one of those terms I kind of get a sense of, you know, what it's about, but I'm a bit stumped for that one.
Mine's a positive socio-ecological transformation. As you point out, too wordy for someone at a bus stop. And I'm actively working to solve that problem.
Academic as well, so that is a perfect place within a thesis or in a journal article or within our discourse, our way of talking.
What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Well, biggest success? I'm late coming to fatherhood. So it's a bit of a cheesy one. But yeah, I've got 3 kids, 2, 4, and 6. And before that, I was a relatively committed bachelor, most of my 30s and 20s and 30s. To find a woman that I love and to start a family, and that's the biggest thing in my life. That actually was what brought me to Whakatāne. And coming to Whakatāne was what allowed me to start working with Doc and really understand conservation from a different perspective. You know, you're kind of aware of it from the outside, but when you're working in the main organisation that's dedicated to doing that work, you really understand how big it is, how much is going on, how much is at stake. So if that's my biggest success of recent, but it was that put me in this world, this environment that I'm in now, originally working for Doc, but now working for Ngā Whenua Rahui, and Rob McGowan, who I said originally, you know, was his wānanga that really opened my eyes. Now he's a colleague, and we work together. So, yeah, the paths have all sort of converged in a good way.
So we're writing a book of these conversations. We're calling it Tomorrow's Heroes. So you're in the mansion. What's your superpower? What's got you into the mansion?
What do you mean? What's the mansion?
The mansion of the people, the superheroes, making a positive change.
What's got me in there?
Yeah. It's got to be real. I'm not letting you have laser sight or flying.
I don't know if you've interviewed many Maori people, but I know there's plenty who can sort of blow their own trumpets, but in general, there's a kind of cultural disposition, I think, to not talk up your anything you might have that's of any value. So I hope it would be because I have a genuine commitment to the world around us and to people. And the people that have known me all my life would, I think, agree. Man, that fellow, when he was a little kid, he was the young idealist in the family that, like I said, argued with his uncles, and we're not surprised he is where he is today.
Being an idealist, a good thing?
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
You positive?
Yeah. I'm sort of stumbling for words now.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yeah, definitely.
Why is that?
I've always been a person who would stand up and confront things that I didn't feel were fair or just. And I've always been able to focus and contribute on towards things that I feel are positive. There's other parts of my personality that might thwart that at times, procrastinating or just being lazy or distracted or whatever. But for many years, you know, I was living in Auckland, and there was a lot of the early 2000s were kind of a time when there was a lot of activism going on, so I was involved in a lot of that stuff. It seems to have dried up a little bit these days. I don't know if people, maybe the need's not there, maybe, or things are just dealt with in a different way. But the big marches that would shut Queen Street down, they don't seem to be as common as what they used to be. But I used to be a part of a lot of those, and I was in a group that played music that would go well with those sorts of marches. So we would often be either directly at the front or the musical accompaniment. The samba band always gets a protest march, rocking along and feeling good about what they're doing. So.
Quickly, because we're running out of time, what motivates you? I was going to say what gets you out of bed in the morning, but 2, 4, and 6-year-old, I can guess.
And jumping on my neck. Some ungodly hour. Like I said, you know, I feel a genuine commitment to what I'm doing. The protection of our natural environment and giving energy, really, and substance to our culture as Māori. So, you know, learning our language, and now having learned that, speaking it, understanding our connection to the natural world and everything that goes with that, and supporting that, and being part of that. All of these things are real collective things, you know, none of them you can do on your own. So it's one of the benefits of working somewhere like Ngā Whenua Rahui or in DOC. You know, you have the opportunity for your working life to be dedicated to those things, as well as all the other stuff that goes with, you know, outside of work life. Most conservationists, you find a on the job more than 40 hours a week.
What's the biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next couple of years?
Well, the family stuff's all there, so that's going to be a big challenge until they turn 18 and get out of the house. Biggest challenge. Well, at the moment, I work for Ngā Whenua Rahui, and our work is on Māori land, and so conservation on Māori land, and a real focus on protection of forests and forest regeneration. So that particular kaupapa has huge potential and is a dedicated bunch of people within Ngā Whenua Rahui who really see that grow over the next few years. So, being part of that.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur?
I've never actually wanted miracles. I've never been one of those. If only I had a genie that would pop out of a bottle, what would it do? I've always been content with my life and the world the way that it is. There's certainly a lot of things that I disagree with. And there's a lot of people and a lot of things in the world that, if you could wave a magic wand and stop them, you'd be remiss in not taking that opportunity. There's a lot of pain and suffering beyond anything that most of us in New Zealand ever experience.
Lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
For the listeners, here's one: learn another language, and as you're in New Zealand, try te reo.
That's a good
point. Te reo Māori will open up, will give you a chance to make friends with people that you would not have made friends with, and it will stand our country in good stead for us to live here together as people from many places. So, learn te reo and reconnect to the bush in whatever way works for you. You know what it is.
Thank you very much for joining me.
Cool, kapo.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lands for Resilience on Radio, which is a show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. I've been talking with Dr. Rob Whitbourne. The show is brought to you, I said that bit. No, I didn't. Yes, I did. The show is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic and co-hosted by Shane Gallagher. That was Sustainable Lands. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens. Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go with podcasts and live streaming of premier local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.